You're fed up with a 9-to-5. You've been working hard for years and you're just not seeing the results you want. You want to break free from a traditional career but don't know how? Business Breaks is here to help.
Subscribe now and rate and review on your favourite podcast platform. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Business Breaks. Today, we're diving into the world of storytelling using visual metaphors with our special guest, PJ Milani. A teacher at heart, PJ has a knack for turning complex ideas into simple, engaging visuals. With over 400 illustrations under his belt, he's grown a following of more than 200,000 people across platforms like LinkedIn, Instagram, and Twitter. His work has caught the eye of big names like Sahil Bloom, Adam Grant, and Stephen Bartlett, helping them and many others communicate more effectively. Beyond the names and numbers, PJ's real magic lies in his daily commitment to making the complicated feel accessible to his audience. Today, he's here to share that journey with us, offering a peek into how he thinks about his work and what it takes to connect ideas with people visually. So let's get started. PJ, welcome to Business Breaks.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here. And thank you for that lovely introduction. That was very nice. I was like, oh, this sounds cool.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm a fan, PJ, and thank you for all the amazing work you put out there and coming back to simplifying the complex. So in terms of your own personal journey and evolution, what inspired you to explore the intersection of visual art and metaphorical expression, and how has this journey evolved over time?
Yeah, I wish I could say it was a well-planned, well-executed, precise journey that I was on, but kind of stumbled into it, to be honest. I initially just started writing online maybe 2 years ago, about 2 years ago. I think I was talking to my wife about this, like initially was like, okay, first thing I'm going to do when I get online is told my wife, I was like, I think I'm going to start a blog. My wife was like, do people still read blogs? And I was like, I don't know. I do. So I created a blog and I was, you know, I just was like, let me challenge myself to write every day for a little bit. And apparently nobody reads blogs. At least no one read mine. And I came across Chip 30 for 30. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. It's a platform cohort-based course run by Dickie Bush and Nicholas Cole. And I was listening or watching Dickie talking on a YouTube podcast, and he was talking about how he initially started writing blogs and how there were crickets for like 6 months. And I just kind of like resonated with that idea. And he's like, well, the best way to kind of get your work out there is through social media. And I was like, I've been avoiding social media for all my life, pretty much. And I didn't know that there was, I didn't know that social media could be used for other than, I don't know, some of that like highly toxic kind of stuff that you might normally hear is online on Twitter and all this politics and stuff like that. That's what I normally thought of social media. And it turns out there's a completely different world out there in social media where people are just sharing ideas and connecting with each other in a more wholesome way. Not always wholesome. I'm sure there's always still trolls and whatnot. But so that kind of just got me started because I started writing with Ship 30. And as I was writing on there, on that platform, I came across like these visual ideas that were being presented online. And I think it was Jack Butcher's work that initially I thought, oh, what is this? Where it was just like a slide. I thought it was like, oh, this is like a presentation slide that's up online. And I, you know, I'm a teacher by trade and I'm a film and animation teacher. I've been teaching for 20 years now. And I was like, well, I create slides all the time and present content all the time. And so I thought, well, why don't I just do what I would do to present an idea in a classroom? And so, you know, I drew something together, posted it on Twitter. That was like back in March 2022. And it got, you know, I kind of equate it to everybody. There's a lot of people that know how to write, but there are very few, it seems, that actually create visuals to try to communicate their ideas. And so by posting that, I think it got more attention than just writing alone. And I was really surprised by it. And so that kind of started me. I was like, oh, here's you make one of the tenets of Ship 30 is make a lot of noise, listen for signal. And so I made a lot of noise. And the signal that I was getting back, though, was from these visuals that I was creating. So I used it to complement my writing initially. And anytime I posted a visual, like, it got a lot more signal. And eventually it got to the point where it takes a lot of time to write. And you need to, you know, if you have a family, it's really tough to take time away from your family to go into a room and write alone for hours. Yep. Excuse me. So what I would do is I would just draw with my kids, and I could do that next to them. And if they ask for milk, I can go and get them milk and then come back to drawing. Whereas writing, you know, if you're writing, you need to like be in it for like the whole time. So I kind of just kept on doing the visual thing. And it wasn't until I just kept getting a lot more positive signal that I was like, okay, so this is something that is interesting and fun. And really, going back to your initial question, like, why do all this, is I think, you know, when you're a teacher, and I teach art, you know, I teach film and animation. When you're a teacher, you generally have this sense of you should be practicing the art form if you're teaching it. And I didn't have enough time to make movies, didn't have enough time to make animations. And I had all these ideas that I wanted to share. And you can go through a visual and iterate ideas really quickly, whereas it would take me like months, if not years, to make a movie. It would take me weeks to create shorter animations, but I can test ideas very relatively quickly with a single visual. So that was kind of like what started the whole thing. And it's continuing to evolve as far as what it is I'm doing. But that's kind of like what got me into this like visual metaphor. It wasn't like something I crafted and then started, which I think is a core lesson here, that you really don't know what you're going to be doing until you're moving in a general direction. And then as you're walking and moving, you can be more precise in the path that you want to take. So yeah, I don't know if that answers your question, but it's a word vomit of like how I started.
No, it's a very fascinating story. And it sounds like it was an emergent strategy rather than a deliberate intention to start drawing and posting it online. You say you were wary, you were perceiving the signals and you listened to them and you responded to them. And it seems to have driven your success rather than, shall we say, hate to admit it, but my strategy is I post for myself. And if I think it's good, doesn't mean anyone else thinks it's good. And if sometimes people get into the habit of, even if no one's responding, they don't take it as a sign. They just double down on it and hope, you know, sometimes it can be about traction. But if you're seeing early success, you really should double down on those signals. So again, perception and responding to what the messages are telling you.
Yeah. And I want to, you know, I do want to add to that. You know, my friend Lawrence Yeo, he has a really great blog called More to That. Really smart guy, very thoughtful. His work is philosophical and he uses visuals too. Great guy. Really highly recommend his content. Or his work, rather. I don't like to use the word content too much. But he has a really great way of looking at this, in that you're balancing out internal motivation with external validation. And you kind of need at least a little bit of external validation in order to keep on the path. And you do want to make sure that your work is inspired by primarily internal motivation. But you have to have a little bit of that spice of external validation. Otherwise, you are writing for yourself or you are creating for yourself. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. It's just that if you want to have a long-term practice, especially when it comes to creating something, it is almost inherent to the art that you need to share it. And I think you need some level of, okay, there is a little bit of a signal in this direction. I love doing this and people like this. So if those two things align, then I'm going to keep doing it. If I don't love doing this, and if I don't think it's good, but people like it, it doesn't matter. There's no reason to connect those two things. So, I mean, like, there are easier ways to be successful than spending and slaving hours away on creating stuff that you don't enjoy doing just for other people. That's probably not the ideal way to move forward in these kinds of pursuits.
Yeah, agreed. And there has to be a return on that investment of your time, especially mm-hmm. if you're sharing out there. And but at the end of the day, it does motivate you to have people who appreciate your work. Mm. And I imagine you have to avoid also falling into the trap of the endorphin rush when you see so many likes, so many comments, high mm-hmm. engagement. But I think that's, as you say, it all comes, how you stay in the game when things get tough is usually down to that internal motivation. But mm-hmm. certainly there has to be some success out there.
Yeah.
And in terms of getting from the journey of point A to B, which is complex, to simplified and visual, mm-hmm. and actually, before I actually thought about that question, I actually watched your YouTube video just before this interview about your three-step process. So, but still, for the benefit of the audience, mm-hmm. can you explain that process, how you translate the complex theoretical concepts into those engaging and very simplified visual metaphors?
Yeah, so, you know, you want to kind of think of it like a little bit of a funnel. And at the very top of the funnel is the first step, which is clarifying the idea. So you want to kind of think, okay, well, what is the actual nugget that I'm trying to get from this particular idea? So let's say you have a giant blog post. You probably go through that blog post and you might highlight or bold one or two sentences that become the main idea. I generally like to kind of explain to a potential client or a client that if you need to be able to distill it down to at least one sentence, and that sentence needs to kind of wrap the entire idea in it. So that's the clarification process, and everything's downstream from clarification. Like, you need to be clear on what it is you're trying to say, and you really can't hide in terms of the kind all the excess stuff. So you want to clarify the message. That's step one. Step two is simplify the meaning. So exactly, I kind of distinguish the difference between clarification and simplification, and that clarifying is for you as the creator and simplifying is for the audience. So you want to simplify the meaning, which is bridging the gap between your intention of the message and the potential perception from the audience. And you're never going to like shrink it all the way. It's like, it's always like an exponential curve. You're never going to get to the edge. So you're just kind of try to get it as close as possible. And that oftentimes that's like taking out complexity. Sometimes it's in simplifying the language. Sometimes it's in simplifying the actual visual itself. Sometimes it's in having some symmetry in the visual so that you're saying a very clean, like, it's not this, it's this, or before and after. So these kinds of simplifications can help the audience get the message very clearly. And then the last step is my favorite part of the process, which is, you know, you kind of think, okay, you got your simplification and clarification and, you know, you're done. But the most important step is actually the amplification process, amplifying. So clarify, simplify, and amplify. And amplifying is when you add some emotion, some interpretation, some level of yourself to bring that vision, that idea to life. And that's where really the most fun kind of happens. I kind of equate it to this, where when most people, when they create or communicate ideas, they think, and this comes from my filmmaking background, that when imagine like what you're trying to communicate to your audience is a circle, like that's message. And most people think you have to draw the entire circle for the audience for them to understand it. And I argue that that is not respecting the audience. And what it also does is it makes the audience passive. So instead of drawing the circle all the way, you leave a little bit of gap at the edge. and you allow your audience to complete that circle for themselves. You draw most of the circle and you just leave this little gap at the end. And so that is what the amplifying part of the process is, where you're leaving that little gap is for your audience to fill it. They can draw and finish that line. And that makes your audience, that takes them away from being a passive consumer to becoming an active participant of your work.
I guess to extend beyond that to visual metaphors, can you explain the process of extending what is initially a verbal metaphor into a visual one? And what are the key considerations to maintain the metaphor's essence?
The thing with whenever we're using a metaphor in speech versus putting something into a visual, and I would even go so far as to say going from writing over to a visual is, especially when you're speaking, you can have a lot of non sequiturs, meaning there's not a logical flow of one thing to the next oftentimes. And that's okay because you're continuing to move the conversation forward. And so you're able to compensate for any holes in your representation of what a whatever metaphor you're using to convey. And I would say it's the same with writing. Now, writing, you have to be a little bit more precise. So, and you can use all kinds of metaphors one after each other, and you can mix metaphors pretty liberally whenever you're writing, or at least you can with it, and it sort of still makes sense. I think the challenge you have when you're making that translation to a visual is you do lose nuances that you are able to compensate for both in verbal and in written form. And so you have to kind of make a little bit more of a stand in your visual metaphor in terms of what it is you're trying to communicate. And that all goes back to like that clarification process. Like, what is it that you're actually trying to say? And you have to try to say something. You can't be saying it's sort of this and it's sort of that, and it's kind of like that. You have to kind of say it is like this. And so that part of it is where you, as you're translating it, you have to kind of come to grips with the fact that you aren't making a nuanced point, even though there's a lot of nuance that you're going to have to rely on the audience to perceive. And that goes back to just how I particularly make these. It's leaving room for interpretation in the visual itself for the audience to kind of bring themselves into it. And some people will see the things that you're trying to convey and some people may not. As far as like what is the actual tactical way of doing this? There is no like blanket way to do it, but what you need to decide on in the metaphor itself that you're trying to convey is, does it lend itself to something that can be visualized in an interesting way? And what is the opposite of that? Or what is the tangential part of that? You have to use a little bit of this comparison form to convey a visual metaphor. At least the way I do it. Now, sometimes you can convey the idea of it is just like this. So let's say I have a visual where I say the same people that don't fit in are the same ones that stand out. So that was the metaphor, but there's no metaphor really in that statement. It's a verbal statement, but there's no metaphor in that. On the visual side of things, I have a bunch of characters of just a row of stick figures, and there's one that's bigger than the rest. And that's the one that stands out, even though, and they don't fit in with everybody else. So the metaphor is actually made through the visual. There's no verbal metaphor if I was to convey that. And this is getting a little bit too tactical, maybe, and maybe not as that interesting, but like to talk about. But it's more like, so if I was to say, some metaphors are really, really easy to translate. One that I think that got me the most attention early on when I was creating these metaphors was, I was saying like, hey, you know, if you don't write your ideas down, it's like trying to hold on to your ideas like water in your hand. Write it down on paper, put it, crystallize it, throw it into a cup, and now you have something to look back on if you need to reflect on it later. And that was just a metaphor I would use with my students to get them to write their ideas down. So that was a very clean, clear, easy metaphor to go from verbal to visual because it was very clear in my head. So I think if the metaphor is good, if it's a strong metaphor, it's going to stand both as a verbal, written, and then visual. The challenge is oftentimes in the work that I'm doing is it's not until I'm actually working through the visual that I understand what the metaphor is trying to say. And so it's not like a translation, it's more like an interpretation. And that's where it becomes a lot more of just like using different strategies, using different ways to think through what is being said. That's where the clarification and simplification parts of the process kind of happen. And then ultimately that amplifying part happens. That's where that whole three-step process kind of works.
Brilliant. Thank you. And that clarifies something for me, that you can't just write something down as a metaphor and then assume it just naturally translates into an image. It's a completely different process, maybe similar in some aspects, but two different things, essentially, or prose in metaphor. Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it's like one of those things where it's not until you're visualizing it that you can understand what is actually being said. Here's one way to kind of describe it is, I was having this conversation with a friend the other day, and because I recently presented at South by Southwest, which is a big festival in Austin, and I presented at the EDU part of that festival. And I was telling my friend, yeah, I'm going to be going. And they're like, oh, that's really cool. And they brought up this idea because, you know, they're a writer, and that how the difference between drawing or visuals and, like, if you say chair, you're saying chair. It's very clear, clean. You're communicating that part of the message really easily and clearly. And I thought about this, and I actually disagree with that, because when you say the word chair, you're actually not as clear as you think you are, because it's actually not as precise as you think it might be, for example. Because if I'm saying chair, you don't know what am I really saying? Am I saying like a lazy boy chair, or am I saying like the Iron Throne from Game of Thrones? How do you know what chair I'm talking about? What kind of chair? If I draw that though, it is far more precise way to communicate that than if I were to use just the word chair. And that's where, when you're translating something from verbal or written form to an image, you have nowhere to hide in the precision of what you create. So if you create a precise idea that doesn't make sense, then you can't hide behind any other words or any other smoke and mirrors. So it can be challenging when you're first trying to communicate these kinds of ideas in a visual form, because again, you're trying to present it in a way that can be easily read. And that part of it it can be, again, something that it's not like, I would also say you kind of have to iterate the idea in a bit of a way too. You don't want to just be like, oh, I don't have the idea perfect yet. So you share it with somebody saying, see what their response is, and then kind of work off of that too.
Fascinating. And thank you for clarifying that, because it sounds like, as you mentioned, and with prose, you read a word, you let your imagination fill in the blanks, and you put the picture in your head, and it can be interpreted by different people in different ways. Like, they'll have a completely different image. Say they're reading a storybook of who the protagonist is, what they look like. I mean, there will be a description, but they'll have someone else in their head, like their favorite actor or whatnot. And that's, thank you very much for that. And I guess moving on to your actual getting down with creating the sketches, and you're very generous with your information. And in one of the comments, you answered someone who asked, so what do you use to draw your sketches? And you say you use Procreate. I actually downloaded it on my iPad, but I haven't used it yet. I'm not sure if I ever will, because I tried drawing, what do they call it, where you do these sort of, transparent paper, and you're kind of sketching over an image. So it was my wife and I on a boat, and it looked damn bad, if I might say so. Pardon the slight curse word. But, and that kind of puts you off, which it shouldn't really. You start off bad and then you carry on. And I thought, It was more that it's going to take me a lot of time to actually get that, get to a state where I'd be comfortable sharing it with anyone. Mm. But I guess you started off with these sketches. Obviously, it was a very, for you, a very quick way to get your ideas out into an image form. Could you explain how hand sketching plays a crucial role in that development of the visual metaphor? And as you say, it's an iterative process. What does the early stage look like of conceptualizing those ideas?
Mm. Yeah. First, before I answer that, to answer your initial, like, I guess, frustrations with drawing and with, I guess, your work not looking the way you would like it to look as before you feel comfortable sharing it. I generally tell my students that creating visual metaphors like this kind of work, it's less about drawing things that are accurate. So, you know, if you wanted to have a perfect representation of what something looks like, take a photograph. And when you're looking at a piece of artwork, what you're no, you know, back in the day, way back in the day, painters would paint portraits. That was their way of making money. And as soon as photography was invented, they were like, why would they hire me and stand still for 5 hours while I paint somebody, and when they can take a photograph of themselves? And that kind of shifted how people painted. And so they had to expand their tool set of what they were actually trying to create. And that allowed an art form to create, to be created, like cubism, impressionism, and all that kind of stuff. All that is to say that if someone wanted something to be perfect and accurate, you can use AI, you can use various different tools to create a perfect representation. I would say it's less about being accurate and more about being interesting. And you can look at a lot of different visual artists whose work doesn't look accurate. Like Tim Urban is a perfect example. Great writer, also great visual thinker. And his work, stick figures, and he communicates his ideas through the fact that the charm of his work is not how perfectly it looks like the human form. It's that he's communicating worlds and ideas through his lens. And it's the imperfect way that he does it that makes it interesting. And if you're familiar with Alex Hormozi, he, you know, wrote several, he has two books now out, $100 million offers, $100 million leads. And he's a multimillionaire. He can hire anyone to do the visuals for him, yet he chooses to make his own. And that's what makes him special and interesting. It's not, and if you look at his work, very imprecise, looks like a child made it. And that's the charm. And so I would say, just to kind of push back on that idea, because I think it's important so that people believe that, or at least understand the difference between visual thinking and creating work that is perfect representations of what it is that they're looking at, that visual thinking is less about making things pretty. I like to say it's less about making things pretty. It's more about making things pithy. And so it's much more important that you make your stuff interesting rather than accurate. Yeah. So I wanted to make sure to touch on that point before we move forward to the tactics on how I actually create the work. Conceptually, I try to, everything starts with how you capture your ideas. And there is like this bank that you build over time in your observations. And there's this cognitive bias, this selective attention bias that you actually kind of use to your benefit as you start creating this kind of work. So for example, you know, if you, selective attention bias is, let's say you buy a red Volkswagen, and then now every time you drive around, you start seeing red Volkswagens. Your attention becomes attuned to the things that are around you to a very specific frequency. And when you start to pay attention to the world around you, like someone who is hungry to recognize patterns, very specific patterns, you will start to see patterns and you will start to see more of them. So conceptually, what I typically do is, as I'm going about my day and as I'm looking around the world, I'm attuned to looking for very specific relationships between objects and people and ideas. And as I come across those things, I either sketch them or write them down or have some place where I can capture them. And that is critical to the process. As you do this, as you do more of it, you build a body of reps and you start to make connections between these things. And those non-obvious connections happen because I try to capture these things on paper. And that's a critical part of the process, because if you put them into some kind of digital interface, and that's important to do too, some degree, I would say capturing something is better than capturing nothing. But the problem with a digital capture device is that you rarely will sift through it unless you're intentionally going through that. Whereas if you have a physical notebook, you have to get through one part of the process. You have to get through pages. You have to get through pages to get to the other side. And so you're consistently looking through your ideas. And a critical part of that process is writing. I actually used to sketch and journal separately. I'd have a sketchbook and I have a journal. Now, I combine those two things together. And what that allows you to do is it allows you to see how your writing might create ideas for your visuals and how your visuals can contribute ideas for your writing. And so having those two things working in conjunction, you're kind of oscillating back and forth between your verbal and your visual side. And so I think that is a critical part conceptually to see patterns emerge in your work. I start physically with drawing on paper, also because it keeps you from getting into this pixel pushing state where you're like, I got to move these pixels here and get this perfectly aligned and whatever, before the idea is even really fully merged. And so it's not until that idea is, and it doesn't take long. Sometimes it's just like, oh, perfect. You see it. And it's like almost immediate. Sometimes it takes weeks, months, because the idea is just not there. It's like, you think it's clear. And I usually say that clarifying process, which is the top of the funnel, you kind of come back at the other end and come back to it. So if like clarifying, simplifying, amplifying, at the end of that funnel, you come back to the top to make sure it's clear again. And so you normally, sometimes I've worked like 3-6 hours on something because I'm like, I think I got this. And it's not until the end that I realize it's still not clear. It doesn't make any sense. It makes sense to me, but I'm painfully aware that the idea is not clear unless I contextualize it. And that's okay if I'm teaching it in the classroom, but it's different if I'm posting it online. If I'm posting it online, the image needs to kind of speak for itself, because most people, unfortunately, in this day and age, aren't like reading too much. They're just kind of like skimming and scrolling. And so if it doesn't make sense within those first 2 to 3 seconds as they go past, it's not going to be clear enough. And they're going to miss an idea that I think is important to share. So that's where I kind of spend more time on those things. Again, that was a lot of words, so I'm not sure if that answered your question, but it is essentially kind of like part of that process.
It's great. I think first off, thank you for reminding me that it's not about perfection, and also to wear those imperfections, you know, kind of like a badge of honor, not necessarily putting it out there, but don't be afraid to show, even if it's not perfect, because that, as you say, quirkiness, it's different. It stands out, hopefully, and that's better than being overly polished and corporate almost.
I want to add to that, in that when I first started, I was very conscious in not trying to have a style. I just kept putting work out there and I tell this to my students who are taking my thinking and visual metaphors course, that I tell them, I'm like, I leave style towards the end of the class, and that's because style emerges over time. It's not something that you can make some intentional decisions, but your style emerges through your imperfections. And it's okay to highlight those imperfections, how you specifically draw a thing that is not perfectly this, that is your style. So how you draw like your arms or your faces, that it's kind of like weird and funky, and it's like not straight, it's crooked, and it's crooked in these same places every time you draw it. That's what makes your style, you know? And so I think it's important that, I just want to underline that point, that your style, your quirkiness, those things are not something to shy away from. And that's what you double down on.
Fascinating. And it's clear that you're a grounded person, which I think, given the success you've had on social media, is great. And actually, it was going to be my other question about, with that social media success, again, how do you balance the expectations of your audience with your own personal creative exploration and growth? And how do you stay grounded in who you are without trying to, shall we say, chase the next shiny theme or object, or adapt your style because you think it needs refreshing?
I think I'm in a privileged enough place. When I say privileged enough, in that I don't have any privilege, like me. I'm not in a place where I feel like the heavy burden of my audience on my shoulders to create something very specific. Outside of the form of using visual metaphors, I generally chase what I'm most interested in or find valuable to express. That is generally the compass that I use to decide whether or not I should be doing something. And I look at everything I'm doing as these experiments that I'm sharing my work online. And it's that when I talk about like doubling down on what works and listening for signal and stuff like that, it's really easy to confuse those things with I'm trying to grow an audience. And the audience, don't get me wrong, I'm very thankful for people who are interested in the work that I do. But if I want to have any message that I want to communicate to anyone that wants to grow an audience, is why do you want to grow an audience? I am looking at it as a form of connecting with interesting people and being, and while that's important to do, I think the more critical thing is I'm doing the work in order to do more of the work. So it's like, I'm not trying to hit any specific amount of money. I'm not trying to hit any specific milestones with number of followers. I think those things are wonderful. I think they're forms of encouragement to keep going. You know, bigger is always better in the mindset of many people. But I think what I've learned specifically, and this is a lesson I learned really, really early on, and this is important, I think maybe this might be helpful to kind of communicate where all this is coming from. So I created those first 3 months from March till June, those first 3 months on Twitter. I probably created maybe 30 visuals during that time, maybe less. And over the course of those 3 months, I went from 3 followers to 1,000 on Twitter. I wasn't on LinkedIn. I wasn't on Instagram. The only reason I had 3 followers was because that third follower was a student, former student, who just happened to find out that I was on Twitter. The other two, one was another teacher somewhere in California, and the other one was like someone on Twitter who was like, hey, you're my first follower. I'll be your first follower if you're my first follower, or something like that. So it was like, I had 3 followers when I first started posting work online or just writing online. Those 3 months, I got to 1,000 followers. On that day that I got 1,000 followers, I thought to myself, all right, here's what I'm going to do. I am going to, in order to celebrate having 1,000 followers, my first 1,000 followers, I am going to take my top 10 visuals and post them. And the next day, I went from 1,000 to 3,000 followers. So in 24 hours, I went from, I tripled my following. That took me 3 months to get to. And you would think this would be exciting. And it was, don't get me wrong, it was exciting. But it also underlined a very important lesson that I think is important to like really think about, in that success of going from 1,000 to 3,000 was not because of the work that I was creating. It was because of the way it was packaged. It was because it was a byproduct of the work I had already been doing up to that point. And it was just by chance. It just happened to be a lucky thing. And so it had nothing to do with the quality of work. And so I think that's important. And that was a lesson I gleaned from that experience, that, oh, people are saying this work is so great and so amazing, but I'm like, I haven't, this is stuff I've already made. So where were you 3 months ago when I made it? Why all of a sudden is it like getting the spark? And because it wasn't the quality of the work. So I'm saying there's a lot of people creating amazing work out there who aren't getting recognized for that work. And it's really easy to think, oh, my work isn't good enough. That's why people don't subscribe to it or like it or whatever. And I think that's important because you have to look at the opposite side of things. If a lot of people love my work, that doesn't mean it's good. So it just happens to be the algorithm gods kind of aligning in your favor. And the same 10 visuals was what were posted recently by Chris Donnelly. Those same 10 visuals that I made 2 years ago, and they got like 90,000, 80 something thousand likes. I don't know how many reposts and whatnot. And to Chris's credit, he was great in like crediting me in his recent LinkedIn posts. But it's just to say, that's the same work. It's the same work. Has nothing to do with the quality of the work. And when you ask, you know, how do I stay grounded? I think it's because I don't believe the quality of the work is represented by the number of people who are following you or whatever. And so I continue to use the, is this something that I find interesting? Am I getting a creative rep in today? Am I talking with interesting folks? Does this provide me the opportunity to connect with folks like Sahil Bloom or Adam Grant or whoever? And it's not to say that there aren't really interesting folks that are not like big entrepreneurs or amazing writers. Mm-hmm. It's just to say that I wanted to be able to connect with interesting folks like yourself and lots of other, like, you know, people who are also struggling through these same things that I struggled with before I started. You know, the presentation I gave at South by Southwest, I was reminded how many people were or are like me in terms of like feeling these things like imposter syndrome, perfectionism, or self-doubt, and kind of hesitating to do anything because you're like, oh, I don't know the right answer. I don't know what I should do next. But I will. And when I do, I will start. And I suffered from that for years and years and years and years. I waited and waited and didn't do anything. And so I think just those kinds of experiences continue to just like keep me going in the sense that I want to be able to do this work as long as I'm capable of doing it and sharing these ideas in an interesting way until AI takes over and does everything for us. But I'm not I think having a social media presence is important. Don't get me wrong. I think, again, it's important to be grateful for any of the success that I've had. But it's not to say that I feel compelled to act in any particular way because of that success. I want to be sure to respect my audience. I want to be sure to be respectful to people who may disagree with anything that I put out there. I just don't want to fall into the trap of thinking that the followers or the social media presence itself is the end. It's a means, and the end is to be able to continue to stay motivated to create work, to be able to connect with folks and to hopefully show other folks that if this is something that you're interested in pursuing, and by it, having some kind of creative practice, whether that's podcasting or whether that's writing or whether that's YouTube, whatever, that I think it's important to have that be a part of your day-to-day life just for yourself. And that's the kind of message I would love to, I guess, put out there into the world.
It's a beautiful message and very inspiring, PJ. Thank you so much. I think that's like the mic drop moment. It's purpose-driven and definitely coming from a place of deep insight and humility, I would say, and service. Yeah. And I think that's what people get. You put a lot of generous insights out there that you invest your time in to make them accessible to people through the visual medium of your drawings. And yeah, I think what I can say is, having met you in person, you've exceeded my expectations. You're exactly how I envisaged you'd be, but amplified. So thank you very much for
that's,
that.
That's very kind of you to say. Thank you.
Yeah, no. And I'd like to sort of wrap up the interview by just asking you three final questions, if I may.
Sure.
So as a person, where do you like to spend your time outside of your creative and teaching pursuits?
Mostly with the family, mostly with my kids, soccer and video games, really. A lot of Geometry Dash and soccer games and that kind of stuff. Mostly family and my wife, that's really it, yeah.
I thought family would be a big part of that, so no, thanks for reinforcing that. And where can our listeners best connect with you online?
So LinkedIn is probably the best place to reach me if you ever want to connect. If you want to follow my work, probably the best place would be my newsletter. I have a visual ideas newsletter. Ideas stands for interesting, design, enchanting, and analogy. I send out like 4 visuals every couple weeks. Try to keep it tight in terms of the content I put out there. And the reason the newsletter is probably the best way, if you actually want to keep up with the work, is if you follow me, which is great, please follow me. And that's wonderful. But you know, there's a lot of chance in algorithm, whether or not you'll actually come across the visual once you follow me. But the newsletter is a really great way to kind of make sure you don't miss any, I guess, top visuals. And the last is probably, I have a thinking in visual metaphors course that I try to teach other people to do this kind of work. And that, you know, anytime I'm in the beginning of one of those classes, like, I have like the biggest smile on my face because I'm like, man, this is just so much fun to, like, I don't know, teach other adults how to, like, who are inspired to think and to like explore ideas in a deep way. It's just, I don't know, it's just a lot of fun. I love doing it. And yeah, so those three different places would be ideal places to, I guess, find me.
Wonderful. And I guess the visual metaphors course is the project you're working on, and more than happy to drop the links in the show notes, guys. So if you want to have what I think will probably be a life transforming experience and creative expression and self-reflection and communication, then I think PJ's course will over deliver, just like he's done on this interview. So thank you very much, PJ. Brilliant. Okay. Again, this has been Business Breaks. I'm your host, Dante Healy, and you have been listening to PJ Milani. PJ, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Business Breaks, all things business podcast with Dante Healy and John Byrne.